So I'll be presenting our work titled Extending SSD Lifetimes with Disk-Based Write Caches. And this is joint work with Vijayan, Mahesh, and Ted from Microsoft Research. And in this work, we're looking at techniques for improving the lifetimes of SSDs because SSDs are starting to replace hard drives in many places. We already have them in MP3 players and cell phones. The good thing about SSDs is that they provide very fast I/O reads, they consume low power, they contain no moving parts, and are more reliable than traditional hard drives. But a problem with SSDs is that they have limited write cycles. And this comes from the fact that SSDs are built out of NAND-based flash, where you need to erase a block of data before you can rewrite into it. And while high-end single-level cell SLC-based drives provide 100,000 erase cycles, the more mainstream multi-level cell MLC-based drives only provide between 5,000 to 10,000 erase cycles. And this becomes a big problem because SSDs are now starting to be used in laptops, desktops, and even servers, which contain much more write-intensive workloads than what you would see in an MP3 player. And this write-intensive nature has a big impact on the write lifetime of the SSD. And we define the write lifetime of an SSD as the maximum amount of data that we can write into an SSD before it stops working. And we did a quick back-of-the-envelope calculation to calculate an ideal write lifetime for a 60-gigabyte MLC SSD. Basically, we took a 60-gigabyte hard drive, and we said if we can do 5,000 erases to it, then the ideal write lifetime of this SSD is 300 terabytes. And because of inefficiencies in the firmware, the actual write lifetime is much less. In fact, the Micron C200 spec sheet says that its write lifetime is 42 terabytes. And the Intel X25M spec sheet says that they guarantee a 5 years minimum lifetime if you write 20 gigabytes of data a day. And if you multiply these two numbers, you find out that its lifetime is 37 terabytes. So you can see the actual SSD write lifetime could be an order of magnitude less than the ideal write lifetime. And to improve the SSD lifetimes, we built the Griffin hybrid device. We're using this device, we can reduce the number of writes we issue to the SSD. And to do this, what we do is we take all the writes that come into Griffin, and then we send it to a write cache. And periodically, we can coalesce these writes and migrate them back to the SSD, reducing the number of writes we do to the SSD. And of course, to build the write cache, we have many different options. The first option is that we can use RAM. The good thing about RAM is it gives you very high speeds, but RAM is volatile, and so it doesn't provide you with durable storage. Another option that we can consider is non-volatile RAM, NVRAM. Again, it gives you pretty good speeds, but it's very expensive to get large capacities of NVRAM. The third option that we have is to use another SSD as a write cache itself. Again, SSDs are expensive on their own, and by having two SSDs in this picture, then that doubles your cost. And then the final option is we can use a hard drive. And while this looks odd at the first glance, it actually makes a lot of sense. And the reason why a hard drive makes a lot of sense is that it gives us durable storage, we can get large capacities of it, and it's also very cheap. And the other thing is that the hard drive provides very good sequential I/O. In fact, the sequential I/O speeds of a hard drive is comparable to a commodity SSD. And so in this paper, we make two contributions. The first contribution we make is that we looked at many different desktop and server traces, and we characterized the I/O patterns that we see. And basically, what we found is that these traces contain a lot of overwrites. And by caching these overwrites, we can reduce the number of writes we send to the SSD by 52%. And using these observations, we designed the Griffin hybrid device that uses a disk-based write cache, where we cache the data on the hard drive and periodically move it back to the SSD. And with our techniques, we show a 2x improvement in lifetime. And we're doing this by servicing less than 5% of the reads from the hard drive itself. So the outline for the rest of my talk is as follows. First, I'll describe the observations we make by looking at desktop and server traces. Basically, we find that there is a huge potential for write savings. And using these observations, we built our disk-based write caching scheme. And after that, I'll present the results that we gathered from our experiments and conclude my talk. To characterize the different I/O workloads, we looked at many different traces. We looked at desktop traces, and these were internal Microsoft traces that were collected from desktops and laptops from within Microsoft. We also looked at server traces, and these traces are gathered by folks from MSR Cambridge, and out of the 36 different traces that they provide, we focused on the most write-intensive ones. And we do this because SSDs are known to do very well for the read-intensive traces. And finally, we also looked at Linux-based traces, and these traces were gathered from folks from Florida International University. And specifically, we had three different traces. We had a desktop trace, an SVN server trace, and a web server trace. And all of the traces that we looked at are traces of block IOs that were collected from below the file system buffer cache. And each trace is a multi-hour trace that contains somewhere between 200,000 to 543 million IO events per trace. And in these traces, we look at three key metrics. The first metric that we look at is overwrites. And we define overwrites to be consecutive writes to a block of data without an intervening read. And in more detail, I show an example where we have IOs issued to block 100 and block 200. So first, we focus on the IOs issued to block 100. And here, we see a sequence of four writes. We classify the first write as to be a true write, and the subsequent three writes to be overwrites. And now, if we compare that to the IOs issued to block 200, we see two writes, but the second write is not classified as an overwrite because there was an intervening read. Next, we look at how fast these overwrites are happening. And to do this, we measure the write-after-write time, which is the time between two consecutive writes to the same block. And on this picture, the write-after-write time for the first two writes is basically the time that the second write was issued minus the time the first write was issued. We also look at the read-after-write times. And this is the time between a write and a subsequent read to the same block. And in these traces, we see a lot of overwrites. And to understand why overwrites happen, we need to look at the lifetime of a block of data. Basically, as the application starts running, it needs to fetch the data from disk. And so at some point in time, it issues a read. And in this case, it issues a read to fetch block 100 from disk. And now the application, now that it has this data in memory, it starts crunching on it. And basically, it's making changes to this block of data while it's in the file system buffer cache. And periodically, some background thread is flushing these dirty blocks back to disk. So the pattern that you normally see is a read followed by a sequence of writes. And after some time, the application stops using this data, and it's evicted from the file system buffer cache. It may be brought in back into memory at a later time, but this is not important for now. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to take these four writes and coalesce them and basically do one write at the end to the SSD. And by doing this, we can get 75% write savings in this case. And this pattern actually becomes more visible when you look at the top overwritten files in the desktop traces. And basically, what you see in these top overwritten files is that these contain a lot of file system metadata files, such as the third entry, which is SQL and bitmap, and the sixth entry. And you also see that search indexes, such as the Windows desktop search and Outlook mailboxes, they also contribute to a lot of overwrites. And in fact, by removing these overwrites, we can figure out the ideal write savings we can get. And we did this for all the traces that we had, which are the desktop traces, the server traces, and the Linux traces. And what we find is that by removing these overwrites, we can get somewhere between 14% to 94% write savings. And our average write savings that we get is 52%. So next, we look at how fast these overwrites are happening. And to do this, we measured the write-after-write times, and we bin them into different time intervals that I show on the x-axis, and I plot a CDF of those times on the y-axis. So first, we look at the write-after-write times. And basically, what this graph is saying is that the overwrites are happening very quickly. In fact, over 50% of the overwrites are happening in 10 seconds. Next, we look at the read-after-write times. And again, what this graph is saying is that written data is read much, much later, where over 50% of the data is read after 10 minutes. So to summarize, we make two key observations. The first observation we make is that the desktop and server traces contain a large fraction of overwrites. And for the desktop traces, we have, by removing these overwrites, we have a potential of 36 to 64% reduction in the number of writes. And the results for the server traces is much more varied, but we can get as much as 94% write savings in the web server trace. And the results are comparable for Linux traces as well, where we get a 62% savings for the desktop and an 81% write savings for the web server trace. The second observation we make is that these overrides are happening very quickly. In fact, over 50% of the overrides are happening within 30 seconds. And the reads are happening after a much longer time interval. So using these observations, we build our disk-based write caching scheme. And to describe our ideas, I'll describe the basic algorithm first and discuss some of the trade-offs that we tune to optimize Griffin's performance. The Griffin hybrid disk has three parts. The first part is a hard drive that we maintain as log structured storage. And we do this so that we can take advantage of the sequential bandwidth that a hard drive provides. The second part is an SSD, and the SSD in our case is our primary storage device. The third part is Griffin itself that keeps track of where the blocks of data are stored, whether on the hard drive or on the SSD. In addition, it keeps track of the next lock position so that it knows where to redirect the next write to. So let's see what happens when a write comes in. So first we have a write, and this write has been issued to block 100, and we want to send it to the hard drive so that we can cache it. And so what we do is we change the offset so that it goes to lock position 1, and then we record this write within the hard drive. And once we have written it to the hard drive, we record this entry in a block map that's stored inside the memory of Griffin, where we're saying that block 100 is currently in lock position 1. And similarly, if another write comes in, and in this case we have a write to block 200, we do the same, and then we record this entry in the block map as well. And now if a read comes in this case we have a read, we first check the block map, and then we find out that this block is really in lock position 1, and so we send this read to the hard drive. And if a read comes in to a block that is not cached, we would send it directly to the SSD. And periodically, we need to migrate this data that's cached on the hard drive back to the SSD. And we need to do this so that we don't incur the penalty of reading from the slower hard drive. And to do this, we basically read the log sequentially. We bring those blocks into Griffin, change their offsets, and write it back into the SSD. And from this basic idea, you can see that there is a natural trade-off between the amount of write savings we get versus the read penalty we incur. And this trade-off is controlled on two axes, which is what data should we cache and how long should we cache the data for. And to improve on write savings, what we need to do is cache all the writes that we get and also keep it for a very long amount of time. And in the extreme case, basically we would have all the data on the hard drive. But of course, this comes at a very high cost because you would have to read from the slower hard drive. And so to minimize the read penalty, we need to cache a very little amount of data, and whatever data we cache, we need to keep it for a small amount of time. And basically, we need to balance these two axes to improve Griffin's performance. And the first axis we look at is what data to cache. And to decide what data to cache, we go back to the traces, and this time we're looking at the overwrite distribution, where we look at what percentage of written blocks, which I show on the x-axis, contribute to what percentage of overwrites. And what this graph shows is that 1% of the written blocks contribute to 70% of the overwrites. And based on this, we can create a selective write caching scheme that works as follows. Basically, inside Griffin, we keep track of what blocks are heavily overwritten. And in this case, we mark block 100 as a heavily overwritten block. And now, if a write comes in, we first check this entry, and if it's heavily overwritten, we send it to the hard drive. And if you have a write that comes in to a block that is not heavily overwritten, we send it directly to the SSD. So the next axis we look at in this trade-off is how long to cache the data for. And basically, I'm repeating the graph that I showed you earlier. And to decide how long to cache the data for, basically we have to look at how often should we do migration. And to decide on that, basically what we want to do is we want to cache the data for a sufficient amount of time such that we capture the overwrites, but not keep it for so long that we incur a very high read penalty. So we want a migration interval somewhere between 10 seconds to 1 hour. And to decide how long to cache the data for, we define different migration triggers. The first trigger that we look at is a timeout trigger, which fires after a certain time has elapsed since the last migration. But the problem with just using this trigger alone is that you could have a pathological case where you can have very high read penalty. And this happens if the workload is very write intensive, that suddenly changes into a read intensive workload. And because migration hasn't triggered yet, you could pay a huge cost for reading this data from the hard drive. To improve this situation, you can define a different trigger, which is a read threshold trigger. And the idea here is basically you trigger migration if the fraction of the reads you send to the hard drive exceeds a certain threshold. And the good thing about this trigger is that it bounds the penalty of reading from the hard drive. But again, just using this trigger alone, you could have a pathological case where you may not have any migration for a really long time. And this happens if the workload is purely write intensive. And so what we do is we combine both of these triggers and we create a hybrid trigger that fires every 15 minutes or if the read penalty exceeds 5%. So up to this point, I've described the workload characteristics and the design of Griffin. Next, we present the results that we get from our experiments. And basically, in our experiments, what we're trying to do is decide on what policies to use, basically the caching policies, trying to determine what data to cache, and also migration policies, where we're trying to decide how long to cache the data for. And we're evaluating these policies using two main metrics. The first metric that we look at is write savings, where we're looking at what fraction of the writes we're preventing from going to the SSD. The second important metric that we look at is read penalty, which is what fraction of the reads are we issuing to the hard drive. And once we decide on these policies, we go back and we look at the performance measurements, which is in terms of lifetime improvement and also in terms of latency. So first we look at what data should we cache. And to do this, we're looking at the write savings for two different caching policies. One is full caching, and the second one is selective caching. And in this experiment, we wanted to remove the time aspect from affecting the results. So in this case, what we're doing is we're migrating the data only at the end of the trace. And what this result shows us is that even with selective caching, we can get a 25% write savings. And this is just by caching the heavily overwritten files. And with full caching, we get much more write savings, where the average write savings we get is 51%. Next, for both of these schemes, we look at the read penalty that we get, which is what fraction of the reads are we sending to the hard drive. And again, I want to remind you, we are migrating the data at the end of the trace. So in this case, the read penalty is an upper bound of what you would see. And in fact, if you were migrating the data periodically, the read penalty would be less. And what you see here is that with selective caching, because you're only caching heavily overwritten blocks, you don't see a very high read penalty. In fact, I think the read penalty is almost close to zero. And with full caching, the average read penalty that we get here is 19%, and this is the upper bound. And because the upper bound isn't so high, for the rest of the experiments, we actually use full caching. So next, we look at how long to cache the data for. And again, we're looking at write savings for many different migration intervals, from 15 minutes to 1 hour. And what you see from this graph is that by migrating every 15 minutes, we capture most of the benefit. And by migrating at a 1 hour timeout gives us less additional savings. So now we look at the read penalty for the different migration intervals. And again, what you see is that 15 minutes pretty much gives us most of the read penalty. And in fact, the average read penalty that we get is 7% for these keys. So given that now we have evaluated the two policies, we're using full caching and a migration timeout of 15 minutes, we look at the performance benefits we get. And then the first result that we look at is what is the lifetime improvement? And we're evaluating it in terms of the number of, actually, the by what fraction of erases, how many erases are we doing compared to if you were using a single SSD alone. And we're evaluating it for two different FTLs, and the FTL is the firmware that maps the logical blocks to physical pages on the flash. And we're running it with two different versions, a simple FTL, which does a coarse grain direct block-level mapping, and an idealized FTL that does a very fine-grained lock-structured page-level mapping. And what we find is that even with an idealized FTL, we're reducing the erases by a factor of 2. And this translates into a 2x improvement in terms of lifetime. And with the coarse grain FTL, because the coarse grain FTL does have a lot of write amplification, the lifetime improvement would actually be much better for a coarse grain FTL. So next we look at the performance in terms of latency. And to do this, we actually tried out many different variations of Griffin, where we used many different drives as the caching device. We tried a commodity 7200 RPM device and an enterprise 10K RPM hard drive as a caching device. We also tried two different SSD combinations, where we did a MLC as a caching device and also an SLC as a caching device. And we evaluate the latency we get for all the different Griffin combinations that we built, and we compare the relative I/O latency to running a single MLC SSD alone. And while the evaluation is kind of a little bit unfair because we're using two devices and comparing the performance to a single SSD, basically what we want to determine is, are we adding too much overhead? And we do this for two different traces, and basically these are the two most I/O-intensive segments that we could find in the desktop traces. And we're looking at the latency we get, the relative I/O latency, to that single MLC case for the two different time intervals. And we're looking at the total I/O latency, and we're also splitting it into read and write times. But the main takeaway from this slide is that by using Griffin, we're not slowing down the performance. In fact, even when we used the commodity 7200 RPM hard drive, we reduced the average I/O latency by 56%. And if you use the much higher-end SLC as a caching device, we're reducing the latency by 85%. We have more results in the paper. Specifically, we evaluate other policies, other kind of variations of the caching policies, and also different migration triggers. And we also discuss failure handling. And this is important because we do have two devices, and so any failure or trying to recover from failures is more intricate. And so what we do is we leverage existing policies from journaling file system and databases to do this. And we have more details on failure handling in the paper. So to conclude, we're looking at techniques for improving lifetimes of SSDs because SSDs are starting to appear in desktops, laptops, and even servers, which contain a lot more write-intensive workloads than what you would see in an MP3 player. And to improve the SSD lifetimes, we built a Griffin hybrid device that uses a hard drive as a write cache. And with our techniques, we're reducing the number of writes we send to the SSD by 52% while servicing less than 5% of the reads from the hard drive itself. And with our techniques, we're improving the lifetime by a factor of 2. And finally, we're also reducing the average I/O latency by 56%. So that's the end of my talk. Thank you, and I can take any questions.
Hi, Rick Spillane from Steinberg University. So I understand from your slide that the primary source of write after writes is the write back thread in the page cache is writing existing pages that are already in the page cache to disk for durability reasons.
Yes.
So
that's one of the reasons. The other ones are could be forcing a sync back to disk as well.
Sure. So then it seems to make sense that it's only going to be generating those writes while the page is still in the cache.
Yes.
So in that case, why did you consider just using the disk as a journal? And then when you actually go to evict the page, write it to the SSD, rather than migrating it from the disk to the SSD?
Actually, that's a very good point, and this is one of the things that we actually discuss in the paper. So the thing is, if you wanted to do this, you need to have file system information. Basically, we need to keep track of what's happening inside the file system buffer cache. And what we're doing is we're trying to build it underneath it, where we're building it at the block I/O layer. Mm-hmm. And at that point, we don't have this information, whether it's a consistency write or whether it's an eviction write. And basically, in the paper, we talk about that. And
but you're going to explore that
in
the future.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Hi there. Keith Smith, NetApp. So at the beginning of your talk, well, first off, I really liked the work. It was a lot of fun. So at the beginning of the talk, you gave some sample numbers for MLC flash drives, you know, roughly how many terabytes you could write to them in their lifetime. And I'm wondering if you could translate your results using those numbers. I mean, so you have traces that show real-world workloads, and given the amount of writes in those traces and the lifespan of these drives, you know, so what does that work out to in hours, days, months of how long we can expect those drives to last, either with or without your techniques?
So that's a very good question. But the problem is it's a little bit hard to evaluate because some of these traces, they were collected from hard drive traces. So maybe the speeds or the amount of writes you would be issuing would vary because the performance of the underlying device is different. So I think it's a bit hard to kind of translate those numbers into SSD lifetime numbers, but that is a good point. I think we should look at that.
Right. So I don't need exact science. Can you just use it as a back of the envelope?
I think we may have results in the paper, but I need to check up on those numbers before I can tell you.
All right. Christopher Hoover, HP Labs. So I'm wondering, particularly on the web server workloads, if you turn off synchronous writes for logging, what does that do to your traces?
The problem is the traces that we had are traces of block IOs, and because we can't modify the traces, we don't know what the settings that they were gathered from. At least I don't remember them. But if we had more detailed traces where we had that information, then we can try to rerun it and figure out what the benefit would be.
I mean, because that's something you often do on servers to improve performance of mail servers, web servers, et cetera. Okay.
So. This is Wei Junxiao from University of Minnesota. This is a very interesting work. So the one more question is, I'm wondering, did you try different kind of workload such as the TPCC, TPCW, something like this? Your paper based on the desktop workload.
Actually, no. So we are looking at the server workloads too, and some of them are exchange workloads, and I think there are proxy servers, there's source, like a shared storage, where you would keep your source code. And I think we also looked at TPCC workloads, and actually, we actually get a lot of benefit for the TPCC and exchange type workloads. So we did look at server workloads too.
Okay. Peter Desnoyers, Northeastern University. I find this approach very interesting. I was wondering if you could expand any on the amount of memory required for the consolidation and migration back, because at first glance, it appears that you would need large amounts of memory to avoid a high seek rate in that.
Is your question asking about how much space do we need for the write cache?
No, how much, when you're migrating the write cache to the SSD, mm-hmm. how much memory do you need to reassemble?
Oh, so what we're doing is we're not using a lot of memory. We're using, I think, 16 or 32 megs. We experimented with both. And basically, we're just reading a 16 meg as big of a chunk as we can from the hard drive, just bringing that 16 megs into memory and then trying to sort it as best we can and then try to write it as sequentially as we can back to the SSD.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Chetan Kumar from VMware. Have you considered the power implications of adding extra hard drive for disk-based cache?
Yeah, so the power implications, basically, to answer that question is twofold, right? So one is, it depends on what environment you're using it, whether in a mobile setting or in a data center setting. In a mobile setting, what we looked at is, if you were using some of the smaller 1.18-inch drives, the power consumption of those is roughly comparable to an SSD. In a server setting, we actually talk about this more in the paper, but one of the ideas that we were thinking about is trying to use one hard drive as a caching device for a RAID of SSDs. And in that case, you're kind of amortizing the power cost between many SSDs.
Thank you.